Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 17th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Larry Rasmussen. The session number is 2006, and it's titled Deep Christian Traditions as Earth Faiths, Song of Songs, Fidelity to God Lived as Fidelity to the Earth. Let's listen in.
My name is Larry Rasmussen. I teach at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And I want to share with you part of a research project that I'm doing, and I think soon will be joined by others. So today's session on that project, which is entitled Song of Songs, Christianities as Earth Faiths. You can't say Earth Faiths 10 times quickly. So. Christianity as an Earth-honoring faith is then the first in the series for the week. And what I'm going to do today is introduce you to the project and the series overall, and then the subsequent sessions, tomorrow, Wednesday, etc., will be on different chapters of that project. At Holden, it's desirable to have both a theme and at the same time allow each session to stand on its own because we're hiking, we're fishing. We've got work to do. So that's what I'm aiming for here. But today is the introduction to the project as a whole. I had garbology this morning from 8 o'clock on, and I think of this project now in terms of garbology. It's sorting traditions, some of which smell badly. And it's trying to recycle them. That's exactly what I'm trying to do, trying to look at those various traditions once we've sorted them and recycle them with a view to how they might be, in fact, a green Christianity, how they might be recycled to create an earth-honoring faith. I mean, good compost out of these recycled traditions. You know, I hope, that Adam is from Adama, which is the Hebrew word for compost. And so it's topsoil, all right? Soil. And all creatures, all of life is from Adam. We're kin to all else. It goes back farther than soil. It goes back to exploding stars. We're all star stuff. But I want to look at the traditions of Christianity. I'm calling them the deep traditions of Christianity, and recycle them to see if there's some good green, fertile Christianity in those traditions. Now, the deep traditions is a reference to the fact that these are traditions that have been around a couple of millennia. And they're cross-cultural, and they have had a variety of expressions. One of my strong interests as a teacher of Christian ethics is an earth-honoring ethic, and I think the wrong way to go about that in Christianity is to develop a kind of ecological theology and create a kind of ecological church as one alternative to other varieties. The better way...
Denomination, huh?
Yeah, another... Or it's what it would be pulling out and joining that, maybe staying in your denomination, but that would be your real church. Were those other green Christians. But the proper way to go about it, I think, is not to create a new eco-church and a new eco-theology, but to discover the earth-honoring elements in those traditions which have seniority, which have tenure, which have been around for a long time, and there's some reason why they are persistent and why they keep showing up again and again and again across cultures, across racial, ethnic communities, across time. So that's why I'm embarking on this project, Song of Songs, Christianities as Earth Faiths. Now, at the beginning of a series, we are asked to push the books that we ask the bookstore to order for us. So I'm going to do that, and I commend to you two of the books. There are others that are relevant there, but two of the books that I ask the bookstore to have on hand. One is by Thomas Berry, The Great Work, Our Way into the Future. And Tom Berry says, each epoch has its great work, its contribution to the great story of the planet's evolution, and in this case, the human moment in the planet's evolution. So the great work of the native peoples of this continent was to find a way to come to terms with the powers of this continent and live sustainably with them. The great work of the Greeks was to give us a basis for a strong Western humanism and a lively life of the mind. The great work of Rome, the great work of India, etc. Well, the great work of modernity, the last five centuries, its achievements in science and technology, in medicine, in education, in agriculture and industry, that great work is no longer sustainable on modernity's terms. It is our way of living cannot be projected as sustainable into the future and generalized for a 6 billion population on the planet and going up. So another great work is in order. And we're in a time of transition from a cumulatively humanly destructive presence to the rest of nature, the rest of the planet, a transition from that to a time when hopefully we achieve a mutually enhancing relationship, not only between human communities, but between human beings and the rest of nature. That's the great work, to achieve that mutually enhancing relationship with the rest of the community of life upon which we totally depend, but which is increasingly impacted by us on a humanly dominated biosphere. So, this is your guide, and that's why it's in the bookstore. And I see this project of visiting communities that I think are already embarked on the practices of the great work as a part of this research project. And the other part of the research project is revisiting the deep traditions to see if they might be part of the great work. The second book is my own. It's called Earth Community, Earth Ethics. And I'm not using materials from that for today. What this project is a kind of a continuation, given what I've done in this book, Earth Community, Earth Ethics. So you might want to take a look at it. Now, this title overall, Song of Songs, Christianities as Earth Faiths. you'll guess, of course, that Song of Songs is a reference, an allusion, to that earthy little book in the Hebrew Bible, where you really have two love stories going on simultaneously. One is between a man and a woman, as a very sensuous love, and it's voiced in that little book of five chapters by a woman, a man, and a group of women. The other love story in the book Song of Songs is between those passionate souls and the land and its life. So that book is just full of the flora and the fauna, and they relish the glories of creation and the riot of life. And no title captures everything, but I wanted a project that understands the relationship between human beings and the relationship between human beings and the rest of creation comprehensively, together, as a single song of songs, as a common love story. And Christianity's, as earth faith, is to underscore the great diversity among Christianities. One could say varied expressions of Christianity. That's okay with me. As long as you understand that this is a wildly diverse religious tradition. When I was in the Coptic monastery in the desert in Egypt, I didn't know. You could have told me this was Arabic Hinduism or something else. I didn't understand anything that was going on. It is a tradition of Christianity that has not been influenced one iota by the strains of Christianity in the West, and that I know. And this is wildly diverse communities of Christians. Of course, there are family resemblances. You recognize the sacraments. You recognize the Lord's Prayer. But they're so attuned to times and places and cultures, and their own practices are so varied. And I think that is precisely the genius of Christianity. I know Orthodoxy doesn't say that. Orthodox traditions don't say that. I think it's the diversity that's the genius of Christianity, so that it can be attuned to time and place, a variety of peoples, a variety of cultures, so that it can be the mosaic. Okay, but the other allusion in that title is to a quotation from a speech in Barcelona, Spain, that Dietrich Bonhoeffer gave when he was an intern in the German-speaking congregation in Barcelona. He gave a pretentious little talk at the ripe old age of 28 or 4 or something on the foundations of Christian ethics, just good German style. And one of the lines in there is this: "The earth remains our mother, just as God remains our father, and our mother will only lay in the father's arms those who remain true to her. Earth and its distress." This is the Christian's Song of Songs. Fidelity to God is lived as fidelity to the earth. That's Bonhoeffer's point.
What year was that?
1928. Only those who are true to the earth will be passed on to the maker of the universe.
He was still a teenager, wasn't he?
No, not 1928. 45. He was born in 1906.
He was about 24.
Yeah, some ripe old age. Yeah. And this is the theme throughout Bonhoeffer. That isn't an idiosyncratic thing in the little exegesis of the Genesis accounts called Creation and Fall. He says, we are our bodies, ourselves. And everything that we talk about as spirit is a dimension of body, just as body is a dimension of spirit. And in the Letters and Papers to Prison, he talks about the utter this-worldliness of Christianity. It's a theme from the beginning with Bonhoeffer. So that's the other portion of the allusion that makes for the title. Now, I underscore here earth and its distress as comprehensive of the community of life. I am not looking for an environmentally sensitive Christianity. Because most Westerners, if you ask them about the environment, they don't include themselves in it. It's what's outside them. That's precisely our alienation. I've got a cartoon on the bulletin board by my office door where you see a car driving down this nice road about to enter a lush area. And there's a sign by the road which says, "You are about to enter the environment." Bonner for men, Earth and its distress, the whole bit of it, and we are part of Earth. One of my favorite passages in the Brothers Karamazov is a point at which Alyosha, whom Karamazov calls the little man of God, goes at night to the monastery cell where his spiritual mentor, the old Saint Zosima, is lying in his coffin, and there's a wake for him. And of course, the scene comes only after tumultuous tears and tortured relationships of love and betrayal and loyalty that inhabit all these thick Russian novels. You gotta kind of get through all of that. And in the dark candlelight, Alyosha hears the account of Jesus's first miracle of water into wine at the wedding in Galilee. And exhausted, he drifts in from the words into prayer and his own running commentary on these familiar verses, all the while in the presence of old Zosima's body and spirit. Alyosha suddenly hears, however, the voice of Zosima, who extends his hand out of the coffin over the edge, and raises Zosima from his knees. I say, what happened here? You know, is Zosima fell asleep. That's what happened. And this is a dream. But Zosima says, "Let us make merry," the dried up old man says. "Let's drink new wine, the wine of new gladness, of great gladness." And then a little later, "Begin your work." This is a vocational moment for Alyosha. "Begin your work, my dear one, my gentle one." And it's in this moment of tender invitation and new vocation that Alyosha, who'd fallen asleep on his knees there, suddenly awakes. And he goes to the coffin very briefly, and he turns abruptly, and then he exits the cell, the monk's cell. And Dostoevsky writes the following: "Alyosha did not step on the steps, but went down rapidly. His soul, overflowing with rapture, was craving for freedom and unlimited space. The vault of heaven, studded with softly shining stars, stretched wide and vast over him. From the zenith to the horizon, the Milky Way stretched its two arms dimly across the sky. The fresh, motionless, still night enfolded the earth. The white towers and golden domes of the cathedral gleamed against the sapphire sky. Alyosha stood, gazed, and suddenly he threw himself upon the earth. He did not know why he was embracing it. He could not have explained in himself why he longed so irresistibly to kiss it all, and vowed frenziedly to love it. To love it forever and ever. Water the earth with the tears of your gladness, and love those tears." It rang in his soul. What was he weeping over? Oh, he was weeping in his rapture, even over those stars which were shining for him from the abyss of space, and he was not ashamed of that ecstasy. It was as though the threads from all those innumerable worlds of God met all at once in his soul, and it was trembling all over as it came in contact with other worlds. He wanted to forgive everyone for everything, and others are, as others are beg forgiveness for me. Oh, not for himself, but for all and for everything, excuse me, and others are begging for me, it echoed in his soul again. But with every moment he felt clearly and almost palpably that something firm and immovable, like the firmament itself, was entering his soul. A sort of idea was gaining an ascendancy over his mind that for the rest of his life, forever and ever, he had fallen upon the earth a weak youth, but he rose from it a resolute fighter for the rest of his life. And he realized and felt it suddenly at the very moment of his rapture. And never, never for the rest of his life could Alyosha forget that moment. Someone visited my soul at that hour, he used to say afterwards with firm faith in his words. 3 days later, he left the monastery in accordance with the words of the late Elder Zosima, who had bidden him, now newborn to earth, to sojourn in the world. That's a kind of conversion to earth and feeling at one with earth, all of it together, that I'm looking for in these deep traditions of Christianity. Some of the elements of that earth-honoring, earth-positive, earth-inclusive Christianity are already there, and we don't have the eyes to see them or the ears to hear them in the liturgies because we live on this side of the Industrial Revolution. We systematically have strained out all that doesn't pertain to the human. So we don't have the feel for the rest of earth that many of the pastoral traditions of Christianity, which are the long traditions, have. When I was in Alaska with the Orthodox Church in Alaska, which is overwhelmingly Native American, they didn't have any problem when the Russians came there with Orthodox Christianity and synthesizing it with Native Alaskan cosmology of earth, land, and sky, because Orthodox theology is so creation-filled. And the priests did what the shamans had always done. When they had purification of themselves by waters, well, that was a whole lot like baptism. There's an Orthodox liturgy for the sanctifying of waters and for the blessings of the fields and for the fish. It's all there already. So it wasn't an issue. I can give other examples, but let me move on here. And say why this trip is necessary.
Larry,
yeah?
I just wanted to say that when you're saying earth-honoring, we should also remember that that's people-honoring.
Yeah, that's exactly my point. Yeah, it's exactly my point, not to separate environment from people. We could talk a long time about such things as that. And maybe we will in some discussion time. I hope you'll just speak up like Michael did. When you've got a question or a comment, just please speak up. In order to kind of make this point of earth and its distress as inclusive of people and the rest of nature, of urban and rural, I'm going to just share with you two vignettes to say kind of where we are and why I think a project like this is a worthy one. So try to say why this trip I think is necessary and why I think all of this is a very practical and rather urgent matter. The first vignette is from the movie, A Time to Kill. It's about the trial in Canton, Mississippi, of Carl Lee Haley, who is African-American, for the murder of two young white men who raped and brutally beat his 10-year-old daughter, Tanya, and then tossed her in the river, leaving her there to die. The scene I'm about to describe finds Carl Lee in prison on the eve of the trial summation. The Mississippi jury is all white. The year, judging from the car models in the movie, looks to me like somewhere late 60s, early 70s. The dialogue in Carl Lee's cell is between Carl Lee and the young white lawyer representing him, Jake Bragance. Jake has taken his own knocks by taking on Carl Lee's case. His house has been burned by the Klan, and his wife and their 10-year-old daughter have left town for the safety of their in-laws. Here's the prison dialogue. Jake Bragance. "We're gonna lose this case, Carl Lee. I want to cop a plea, maybe second-degree murder, with life in prison. Carl Lee Haley. I can't do no life in prison." Jake. "The jury has to identify with the defendant, and I'm a lawyer and you're a gardener. I live in the valley, you're on Thomas Hill, Carl Lee. Yeah, and you're white, and I'm black. See, Jake, you think just like them. That's why I picked you. You one of them. Oh, you think you ain't, 'cause you're on TV trying to get me off talking about black and white. But when you look at me, you don't see a man, you see a black man." Jake. "Carl Lee, I'm your friend." Carl Lee. "We ain't no friends, Jake. We're on different sides of the line. You live in a different part of town. I don't think you even know where I live. Our daughters ain't never gonna play together." Jake. "What are you talking about?" Carl Lee. "America. America is a war, and you is on the other side. How a black man ever gonna get a fair trial with the enemy in the bench, on the bench, and in the jury box, and my life in white hands? You, Jake, that's how. You my secret weapon, 'cause you're one of the bad guys. You don't mean to be, but that's how you was raised. Nigger, Negro, black, African American, no matter how you sees me as different. If you was on that jury, what would it take to convince you to set me free? That's how you save my ass, and that's how you save us both." The relationship of Carl Lee and Jake is what I call a structured enemy relationship. Haley and Bragance have to find a way to be allies. That's how you save my ass, and that's how you save us both. But their relationship is race-riddled. It's mired in a history that reaches back to the Middle Passage and to slaves and slave owners in Mississippi. That relationship is essentially antagonistic and will be as long as America's most deep-seated social problem persists, white racism. Bragance pushes that relationship away because he thinks he's crossed over as Haley's friend. But his 10-year-old Hannah and Carl Lee's 10-year-old Tanya won't likely share a common future, perhaps not even play together. Their own innocent relationship was already a structured enemy relationship. Doesn't matter how they feel about one another. A structured enemy relationship the day their mothers, privileged white and plain black, pushed them with pain and joy from the womb. Now, I want you to keep that one in mind. This is the second vignette. Second vignette is from the American Museum of Natural History in New York City at 81st Street and Central Park West. You get off the C train, the subway, and you walk underground right into the museum itself. You ascend one floor to the new Hall of Biodiversity. The centerpiece is a detailed cross-section of the Zanga-Sanga rainforest, which is an extension of the Congo Basin rainforest in the Central African Republic. The purpose is clearly educational, though the effect is rather aesthetic as well. The nature and the indispensability of biodiversity is explained, as are the efforts needed to sustain the forest together with its peoples. And in the background, you always see on video the peoples in this recreated rainforest. Of course, biodiversity isn't a matter of rainforests as such. Biodiversity is the sum of all species living on Earth in their habitats, and we rely on it for most everything. Not only for food and fuel and fiber and medicine and countless natural products, but for the functions that sustain life itself. Cleansing, recycling, renewing. Biodiversity, this exhibit goes on to explain, makes and keeps Earth habitable through the purification of air and water, control of floods and droughts, protection from ultraviolet light, generation and renewal of soil fertility, detoxification and decomposition of wastes, pollination of crops and natural vegetation, maintenance of diverse habitats and ecosystems, control of agricultural pests, cycling of crucial nutrients, modification of temperature extremes, and the forces of wind and rain. And then it goes on to say it's also a force in our cultural life and that many faith traditions have images taken from biodiversity. All right, now stay with me a minute here. The attention getter, however, isn't really this section of the rainforest and the explanation of biodiversity. It's a panoramic display of habitats nearby. They're on 18 waist-high tilted panels. And across the panels move slow-motion video color display of Earth's diverse habitats. Coral reefs and wetlands, tropical forests, freshwater wetlands, rivers and lakes, oceans, temperate and boreal forests, tundra, grasslands and savannas, islands. The scenes change and they're constantly changing again. Sometimes a single habitat goes all across these 18 panels. An ocean shoreline or a mountain in autumn or a high desert in the spring bloom. And then what happens? Then scenes of humanly degraded human degradation move into the panels and interrupt these more pristine presentations, and then sentences appear and enlarge and move to the left and move to the right to the same slow rhythm as the display of life. No arguments made, nothing is really explained. It's just a drumbeat of data. An area of rainforest the size of Switzerland is lost each year in Southeast Asia. Only 6% of the world's forests are protected. Acid rain can fall as far as 200 miles from a pollution source. 80% of the mangrove swamps in the Philippines were destroyed by 1985. Humans have developed 1/2 to 2/3 of the Earth's land surface. Only about 0.1% of pesticides reach their target. Habitat loss has resulted in the loss of 90 native Amazonian cultures since 1900. Humans erode 71 tons of topsoil per day. 1/3 of the population of developing countries lacks access to safe drinking water. 3 million tons of oil pour into the sea annually. Since 1970, the world's fishing fleet has expanded twice as much as the catch. Human population has grown more since 1950 than in all previous history. Global water usage has tripled since 1950. What's the point? The point is simply that ours is a structured enemy relationship to the rest of the planet. That's the point. So the context of this project is the realization that we live in a variety of structured enemy relationships, and it's the ethics of reconciliation that I'm interested in. How do we move now into the great work of mutually enhancing relationships rather than structurally enmied relationships. Okay, I'm just gonna quit here in a few minutes with just show you an overview of the project. I've just described the setting. And the first part is a kind of description of the context in which we find ourselves. I've shared a little bit of that with you. In more detail, I talk about it as three waves of globalization: commerce and Christianity, conquest and civilization as the first wave of globalization starting 500 years ago. That's the first time we put the whole planet together. Those bawdy sailors figured out how to manage the big currents on the big oceans. And the whole planet became globalized 500 years ago with the sliding out from Western Europe of white Christian civilization and the establishment of neo-European civilizations around the globe. That's why you all are sitting here and not in Germany and Scandinavia and other places if you'd have stayed home. So that's the context, in the context of structured enemy relationships as well. And then the second part of the project is a visit to communities that are already doing the great work. They're busy with social justice and environmental issues tied together inextricably because they are together. So the second part are to communities. One of them, I'm not going to show you the pictures, but the first one that I went to was the Orthodox Church in Alaska, Native American Alaskan, and I like the phrase that they like: Earth is the icon that hangs around God's neck. Isn't that lovely? Yeah. It's an iconographic tradition. No, this was on Kodiak Island, which is the oldest part, which is where the Russians established the first settlement at two harbors. There, you can see, if you just look at the clergy, you can see the Native American. It's predominantly Native American. Okay, I have to play here a bit.
Larry, can I ask a question?
Yeah. Yes.
I was reflecting on an experience I had, 6 or 7 years ago, where I revisited a church camp, a Lutheran church camp, Luther, whatever, however you want. It has to be the Luther boy. And I had been a counselor there previously in a much younger time in my life, and was back to talk about how to do environmental education with the children who would be coming to the camp. I was doing some counselor education. And we got completely stuck on two things. Number one, they didn't see themselves as teachers. They saw themselves as pals. And number two, they were gathered there to praise Jesus.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any understanding of using the setting to talk about anything, any other aspect of God or spirit or anything than Jesus. Needless to say, I wasn't invited back the next summer to any further counselor education. But I'm wondering, in these traditions that you've visited, I don't know if there are children in those places or if there's any trickle down to the education of children.
Yeah. There were children in some of these places, and always a concern about will the faith have children and will the children have faith? But on the one hand, I'm not surprised at what you found. On the other hand, I'm a little surprised because it's usually been in Bible camps and in hymnody that the presence of a sense of creation is still present, when it's been lost in theology and in the creeds and in the sermons. It's often still present in those other places. At the same time, I'm not real surprised because, was it a Lutheran camp?
Yeah.
And especially Protestant traditions have become what you might call, instead of genuinely Trinitarian, they're kind of monotheists of the second person of the Trinity. And everything has to be understood in terms of Jesus Christ. Forgetting the Spirit, who is the Spirit of all creation, in, with, and under everything that exists, the Spirit that broods on the water. The Spirit, the Ruach, the Hebrew word you can't distinguish between the breath that you're taking and the wind that you feel and the Spirit of God. They're all the same word, and it's all different dimensions of the same thing. But we're not good at the third person of the Trinity, and not real good at the first person of the Trinity. We spend our time with the second. And so that severe Christocentrism is an issue. And then it gets reduced out of medieval Catholicism and out of the Protestant Reformation itself. It gets reduced to a focus on which the only axis that really counts is the axis between God and people and how they're doing with
God. And God and me.
And it's even God and me. Yeah. And so salvation becomes an issue of the person and the person standing before God, not the redemption of creation, as any Hebrew prophet would tell you it's all about. So there's a lot of...
You can get to that bigger picture through Jesus, too.
You can.
Through Colossians 1.
You can do it, and you do it through a cosmic Christ.
Yeah.
And many traditions have a cosmic Christ. But Lutherans, by and large, haven't done that, with the exception of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Joseph Sittler and a few other folks. Part of this project is in the conviction there's a whole lot of theological repair work that needs to be done. And we need a lot of volunteers to do this. So the second site is the Marinol Ecological Sanctuary in the Philippines, Baguio City, northern Philippines, where the cosmic journey is the hymn to the universe. So this is Catholic sacramentalism, where in the liturgy itself you are enacting the great drama of creation. And what these folks have done is have build a bio shelter instead of a convent after the earthquake wrecked their convent. And then they have a cosmic journey where they have 14 stations on the side of the mountain that are the 14 stations of the tale of evolution. First station is the emergence of the universe, the Big Bang. And then the tale of evolution, story of creation to date, as the revelation of God, the flaming forth of the universe from the heart of God. And so that's their way of getting at the great work. And they do it in conjunction with working with people in the tribal, especially in the tribal communities who are suffering the loss of their communities and their lands because of big international mining and timbering of the mountains of Baguio. And they're perfectly at home getting those two things together. Namely, that's Earth and its distress, all of it together. The third place I visited, and then I'll get to the deep traditions here at the end of this, and we'll still have some time. Are the African Association of Earthkeeping Churches in southern Zimbabwe, where African independent churches, African initiated churches, those are the ones who protested the mission-planted churches of the Europeans because the mission-planted churches didn't affirm African culture. So they said, we want to be Christians, but we want to be African Christians. And in southern Zimbabwe, they've all joined together, 150 of them, 2 million Africans, and they understand the church's mission to be earthkeeping. Every time they have Eucharist, they plant trees as a part of the liturgy, if it's planting season. Or they dedicate seeds, or they gather in the harvest. Now, when it's planting season, Communion goes on for 3 days, so you got to be ready to spend some time in church. But of course, church is outside anyway, so it's not a big issue. All right, those are they're regaining the lost lands, reclothing the earth. The lands were lost to the Brits, the settlers who took the best lands from them. And then they were lost to the Mugabe government that didn't carry out the land reform that the War of Independence was fought over in 1911. And now you know, if you've been reading the papers or watching the news, that ex-combatants from the war from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe have occupied the commercial farms and are demanding that land reform. Well, these church people are a part of that effort to regain the lost lands. But they, in the meanwhile, they have to live on the communal lands where they were forced to live by the fact that all the white folks got all the good land. And the communal lands have become degraded, in part at their own hands, cutting down the trees. So they're regaining the lost lands, reclothing the earth. That's their phrase for what they're doing. They also call it the War of the Trees. It's a continuation of the War of Independence. Now they're restoring the earth. So that's what they're up to. So earthkeeping is their way of talking about the church's mission. It is an example. I said the Marianollers were an example of sacramentalism. The Zimbabwe folks are an example of prophetic and liberative practices, where you're seeking power to redeem and share power and redeem all of life. Then I went to South Africa to. Oops, I gotta get some response here. To the Kanya program of the Methodist Church of South Africa, which is a rural development program. Under apartheid, everybody was so busy getting rid of apartheid, spend a whole lot of time thinking about what comes afterwards, or didn't have the resources to attend to it. So the churches are now getting involved in a way they weren't in rural development. And this is a church of the Methodist program of the Church of South Africa. And if I had more time, I'd show you their architecture for the new church, because it's earth and it's distress, it's the whole community of life. Their traditional housing are rondables, circular houses. The new church that's being built right now is three rondables. You come in one, rondables about this shape only, of the fireplace here only, it would be twice as large. You come into, or three times as large, you come into it, and that's where the people sit, the native, so to speak. And then the second rendezvous, which overlaps, and you look into it because there's a space through, is the granary of where the seeds are kept and the produce from the church gardens are kept. And the third rendezvous is the cattle crawl. And all this is church. The cows are in church. The flora and the fauna and the seeds are all in church. That's all church. So you look into the cattle crawl and you look into the granary from where you're sitting. And the altar is where the three overlap, because that's the center of the earth. That's what holds it together. And in the back there's a big tank of water. And the water's for the grain, and the water's for the gardens, the water's for the cattle, and the water's for baptism. Okay, let me, Wadi al-Natrun, the tradition of the Desert Fathers and Mothers. I want to know if the Desert Fathers and Mothers tradition, which is a powerful expression even to this day, if some of you read Thomas Merton, you read present day expression of the Desert Fathers. I want to know if that's a green tradition, or if that's Christianity as an earth faith. So I went to the Coptic monastery in the Great Western Desert, the Desert of Cetus, the inner desert of the Great Western Desert, where there have been monasteries since the 4th century, and where one of the places where monasticism began. And I wanted to know whether the tradition of asceticism, of rigorous disciplines of the Christian life, where you say yes to one way of life and no to another way of life, is a potential for an earth-honoring Christianity. So I went to see how it was that these monks and Coptic lay Christians who work there as they come to do a 40-day retreat, it's 40 days in the desert retreat, everything's theological, why they're so fabulously successful at greening the desert, which they are. And it's related to the tradition of the desert fathers. The desert is the place of barrenness, the place of death. If you show Eden or new creation, if you show life in the desert, that's the presence of the new creation in the midst, on the home turf of death.
And this is where?
In Egypt, in the desert in Egypt. Let's see. And the last one is the Iona community, and I talked about that for some of you were here last Saturday, yeah. Which is off the western coast of Scotland in the Inner Hebrides. And Iona has been a Christian community since, I think, it's either 563 or 583. When St. Columba founded the Celtic monastery there. And it was Celtic for four centuries. Celtic Christianity has always been a green and earth-honoring Christianity. It's a tradition of asceticism, and I'll talk about that. But after four centuries of being Celtic, then it was Benedictine. And there's an abbey there that's now restored. Was restored, actually, by the Reformed Church, which means the Church of Scotland, Presbyterians, and is now an ecumenical community, a bit like Holden. I noticed the other night when we were giving a blessing to folks who were leaving, what was used was a Celtic blessing. Okay, then let me finish with this. The third part. First part was our context, structured enemy relationships, globalization. The second part are the site visits to the communities. And I will go to other communities, and I have gone to other communities. Sisters of Loretto Earth Network, which is Roman Catholic sisters, out of St. Louis, for example. And my time at Holden these 2 weeks, I'm writing up Holden as one of the communities. With practices and the drawing on the traditions that and changing them in the process of being a more earth-honoring and earth-inclusive community. So now I want to look systematically at these traditions. This is the garbology part. This is the sorting the traditions and doing a critical appraisal of them and then recycling them. With a view to their potential. Community asceticism is one, such as the Egyptian monks, such as the Orthodox, where the gist of the tradition of asceticism, 2,000 years old in every tradition, is that of saying yes and saying no in a disciplined way of life in order to form a counter-world. What asceticism is all about, is formation. Formation of human spirit, formation of human community, in order to be an alternative to the dominant way of life. So it says yes to one way of life and no to another in a set of disciplines. Asceticism comes from the word ascesis, which means training, discipline, as in discipleship. Another deep tradition that I'm going to look at, and communities combine these. It isn't that a community only lives out of one of these traditions. The Maryknoll sisters are sacramentalists primarily, but there's also an asceticism there, and lots of a prophetic liberative strain in their Christianity. So sacramental communion, which is the tradition that dominates in Roman Catholicism, in the Orthodox Church, in Anglicanism, and in some sense in Lutheranism, with the sacraments at the center, is ritually enacted community as the hymn of the cosmos itself. It'll take some time to talk about that. That's why we're not doing it now, and why we're going to do it a couple days from now. The third tradition, the constellation of traditions that I want to look at, are the deep traditions of mysticism and the contemplative life. What in the traditions of the mystics and the contemplatives is earth-honoring? There's much there. You know, when you read the visions of the mystics, what is never left behind, this effort to leave the world, what's never left behind is nature. They're always rich with the members of the community of life. We sometimes think of them as kind of earth-denying or body-denying, and some are, but many are not. So quietly listening to the heart of the world in order to hear the heartbeat of God as a kind of gist of the mystical and contemplative tradition. Okay, lastly, prophetic liberative practices where the focus is on shared and saving power to free and redeem all of life. The African earthkeeping churches trying to achieve a land reform that makes it possible for that population to live together and at the same time restore the land. So this is it's often heavily political because it's always entailing the reforms in society, reforms of systems and structures of society. That's always the emphasis in the prophetic liberative tradition, whether it's from the Hebrew prophets or whether you're talking about the civil rights movement or the social gospel, whatever you're talking about. It's a focus on the way in which society is organized and ordered as life-giving or death-dealing. Okay, that's the project overall. And I'm sorry to have monopolized all of this time this time. What the subsequent days will do is take each of those deep traditions in turn and ask about its potential. The traditions of asceticism, some of you probably have come out of that. I came out of a community that was a very strong Protestant ethic, and we were to work hard and save but not spend, and we were to live frugally. My grandmother saved absolutely everything. and not never waste anything and don't indulge in material pleasures, but nonetheless, put in a good day's work. That's a Protestant ascetic community. And I think there's a whole lot to be said for loving the earth fiercely in a simple way of life as a message to consumerist America. Yeah, consumerist America. The monk that was ordained in the pilgrimage in Alaska, the Orthodox monk, who's a hermit, lives out in an island and prays for all creation from his island. In his sermon, when he was ordained, he said, 68,000 channels you can get on cable TV and all of it trash. So he was asking folks to be a little more circumspect about how they spent their evenings. There might be something better than 68,000 choices of trash.
So, garbology.
Yes. Phil.
Is your project mostly information gathering, or is the other half of it is solution finding?
Yeah, it's both. It's both a descriptive account, the information gathering. Where are the people that are doing the great work already, and what are they doing? Documenting it, like at Holden, writing up Holden. But the other half is a constructive, or as we say in ethics, a normative project. We're recommending something. Yeah, we'll say this is what folks are doing, and we think this is good for the following reasons, and take it into account. Yeah.
So it's funneled all through the churches.
What?
Funneled through the churches.
Well, I teach in a Christian ecumenical seminary, so that's the focus there. But I'm glad you asked that, because these deep traditions, asceticism, sacramentalism, mysticism, contemplation, prophetic liberative practices, cross the world's great religions. So it is inherently interfaith as well. Buddhists and Hindus are great ascetics. And Buddhists have a sacramental view of the universe. So the potential for being more than churches, but being broadly interfaith is considerable. But I can't do that, all of that. But I want to find other folks who can help. Yeah.
It might be an extraneous question, but as you're talking, I think of my image of the American Indian before the white men settled this country, and then we sought to Christianize those people. Are there any remnants of that earth faith that carried forward in with that cult, that American Indian culture, that still remain?
Yes, there are. Strongly? There are. And there are two things that can be done. One is there's no reason why this sort of look for communities who are doing the great work, in Barry's sense, need be tied to particular religious orientations. I'm doing that because that's what I teach. But you could spend time with Native Americans and other indigenous peoples to ask that very question. But I'm also going to spend some time with Native American Christians who ask how what have they done with the Christianity that they got. Just as African Americans changed the plantation Christianity a great deal and transformed it into the Christianity of the African American churches, so I'm interested to find out whether remnants of Native Americans who are Christians, what they've done with that as well, that retains their pre-Christian integration with the powers of the continent. Yeah.
Larry, it sounds like the examples you have of groups doing the great work have essentially withdrawn from the mainstream of daily life, or they're doing.
Uh-huh.
They're doing their example, like Holden,
yeah,
off the side,
yeah,
if you will.
Yes.
Is that, number one, is that true? I mean,
yeah.
Am I hearing you correctly? And will you be talking this week about the integration of, I speak out of a community which is forcibly invited now to be about the great work based on environmental species acts as they impact our community.
I see.
I live in the Walla Walla Valley, and
yep.
It's an area of agriculture, and the federal government came to us in February and said you can't have any water this year,
yep.
Period.
Yes.
And that's $5-7 million of agriculture that will drive and blow away. So we engaged in a conversation about,
yep.
And one of the things that struck me from your hearing was people in the valley feel that the government has forgotten we're part of the environment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of one of the main responses.
Yeah.
Probably not also. So.
Well, first of all, yeah. It's a structured enemy relationship.
Yes, yes.
You've got conflicting interests.
Right.
But you are part of the environment, so how do you do it all together becomes the question. But to answer your question, I will also be looking at congregations and not just communities. This was a monastic community, a religious order. Now the Orthodox Church in Alaska was parishes. and congregations. Iona is a kind of lay order, so to speak. They're dispersed. They're all over. They don't live on Iona Island. They come there and go from there. But they have their disciplines, and they meet in families where they live. So it's but there are congregations, so I will be looking at congregations. At the same time, the leadership, I think it's going to be clear when I get done with this. I don't know. It's a hypothesis. The hypothesis is that these communities that are already communities can take leadership that other people often can't, because you got to convince everybody in your congregation. The most forward groups are Roman Catholic Sisters. They've now organized themselves as the Sisters of Earth. Well, that's because they can decide this is our charism, this is our gift, this is our ministry as a community, and they can just go with it. They don't have to be a committee in the congregation that it has to convince the rest of the congregation this is what we should all do. So it may be that there's something to the fact that these communities are out in the forefront as communities. But I'm not interested in only looking at religious orders. I'm interested in how this is dispersed throughout the most common forms of the church, namely, especially congregations.
Larry, on that issue, are you, in addition to some of this working its way into your teaching at Union, which I assume it will, is there a book? Is there a curriculum for congregational use? How does it get to congregational life?
Yeah. Well, it's too big a project for me. So I'm going to spend some time this fall trying to organize a collective research project, which will be a documentation and writing project. So it'll be publication. I've got a graduate student. I've got a number of doctoral students who are doing work in these areas already. And one of them is going to help me put a website together on what I showed you here. And eventually it'll be a series of books. Not one, but a series of books. But that's a long ways down the road. And farther than that, haven't thought in terms of like curriculum, etc. Time is up, folks. Thanks.